Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Three little letters, people. G, I, and G. The gig economy is where we're at today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 11th of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today with a story that is almost certainly the very first step in a very long and possibly litigious chain of events. But the news is what the news is, and this one could be a biggie. California is rewriting the rules on when a worker is an employee and when that person is an independent contractor. Changes to the law are all but done in the California legislature, with the gig economy clearly in mind. Apps like Uber and Lyft, DoorDash and Postmates, where workers who are key to the company's business are classified as contractors, which means they don't get health insurance or other benefits, of course. But how you feel about what California is doing kind of depends on where you sit. So we sent Marketplace's Ben Bradford out into downtown Los Angeles today to talk to some of the people who are in that gig economy.
It took about 3 minutes from when I tapped the app for Anisha Turner to pull over and pick me up in her white Scion.
Hey, how are you?
Turner is one of Uber's almost 4 million drivers. Lyft has about half that, and I'm one of her first rides today.
I just came out here, but I plan to be out here at least probably about 8 to 10 hours today.
Turner's been driving with Uber for about 3 years, and she's skeptical about becoming an employee.
You get health insurance and those kinds of things.
Well, you'll get health. Okay, we'll get health insurance. And what else?
Being reclassified as an employee would mean minimum wage guarantees, overtime, and meal breaks. But Turner's concerned it would allow the company more control to set her schedule.
That's the thing, though. I don't want it to be like a regular job. That's the point of why we even started driving.
Turner doesn't want to drive forever. She wants to attend esthetician school this fall and schedule her driving around that.
Marketplace's Ben Bradford, the first of a couple of times we are going to hear from him today on this story. We ought to add here, by the way, that Uber said today it is not going to reclassify its drivers as employees when the California law goes into effect January the 1st. The company says the driver's work is outside its usual course of business. See also my prior remarks about this being a litigious chain of events. All right, moving on. There was a breakthrough of sorts in the trade war today, of sorts being an important qualifier, and it wasn't really a big breakthrough either, but you take what you can get. China said it's going to get rid of the retaliatory tariffs that it has in place on 16 different American imports, shrimp, fish meal, some cancer drugs as well. Nothing, though, agricultural, the slice of the American economy that is getting hit the hardest. And for all that China's dominating the trade conversation, there are a whole lot of other countries out there and a whole lot of other tariffs. Which gets us to one Patrick Smith. He is one of our go-tos. He grows apples at his family's ranch up in Yakima, Washington. Patrick, it's good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you, Kai.
So look, are you guys in the middle of harvest now or what? I frankly don't know the timing.
Yeah, we're about 3 weeks into our apple harvest and about 2 weeks into hop harvest. And yeah, so far so good.
Well, what does that mean, so far so good? Because as we've talked before, you know, with tariffs and trade and all that jazz, it's not like apple trees can make less apples. What are you doing with all the stuff you're reaping here?
Yeah, no, that's a good point. We're right toward the end of the marketing season for the 2018 crop as the 2019 crop has started to come in. And the export numbers for the year are down about 30% overall. But of course, that pain is not spread equally over all of our export markets. And so we continue to have challenges in places that have been impacting us all year. And that's having a downward effect on prices. But yeah, we're hoping that a swift resolution is on the way.
Yeah. When you say hope, do you actually mean hope, or are you just kind of resigned now?
Probably more of the latter, to be honest with you. You know, it doesn't seem like things are moving all that quickly, despite the news cycle being something new every day. But probably the biggest impact to apple exports has actually been in India. India had been our second leading market for exports of Washington apples, and we're down 67% there. And that one doesn't seem to make the news much. I don't know how much effort is being put into fixing that dispute.
Yeah, so. China is sucking up all the oxygen, that's for sure. So you do apples. We talk about that all the time. You do hops. We've talked about that from time to time. Do you guys do anything else? I mean, are you diversified at all?
Yeah, I mean, hops and apples are our primary two crops, but we've also got a little bit of peppers. We've got a hemp trial going on this year, a little bit of pears, you know, various other things to keep us busy, but hops and apples are still number one and two around here.
So look, let me ask you something, and I promise I will not be offended by this answer, but it goes sure. to a more macro thing. Are you just sick and tired of talking about this stuff? When my producers call you and say, hey, Kai wants to chat, do you go, oh, man?
No, you know, I mean, it's important to continue to have these conversations. But yeah, I mean, to be honest, one of the nice things about harvest is that I'm so busy with everything else that I'm not as in touch with yeah. every ebb and flow of the news cycle. And so the distraction has been nice, but no, I'm happy to talk to you anytime.
When we get off the phone, what are you going to do? I imagine since it's harvest time, you've been up since 3 o'clock in the morning or something, right?
Yeah, about four.
Oof.
But during this month, I spend most of my time around picking facilities and drying facilities. So I'll head back out there and make sure everything's going the way it should.
Patrick Smith at Loftus Ranches. We got him, as he just said, in the middle of harvest. Patrick, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
No problem, Kai. Thank you.
6 days in a row now that the Dow Jones Industrial Average has said trade war. What trade war? S&P and the NASDAQ did the same. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. For all the press they get, Uber and Lyft aren't the gig economy all by themselves, right? And the gig economy itself actually is way more broad than most of us think of. Ben Bradford grabbed, yes, an Uber to a nail salon in downtown L.A.
Nailsholic is a small, rectangular, brightly lit shop with maybe a half dozen chairs. Susan Lee is welcoming customers at the front and explains what they offer.
Like acrylic, mani, pedi, we give them all that service.
Even though she works pretty regular hours at one of the chairs in the salon, Lee is an independent contractor. She and her coworkers have discussed advantages of becoming full-time employees under California's new law.
With us, I mean, it's better for us. You know, we get benefit and stuff.
But Lee also says being independent has given her flexibility. She regularly goes to work in other states.
Oh, I'm like all over the place. In Florida, Boston, Georgia, North Carolina, South Carolina. I'm like everywhere.
She's not sure whether the potential benefits outweigh the value she gets from being able to work where she wants and when she wants.
No manicure for Mr. Bradford, just another Uber ride. Straight ahead, more from him later. Now, a story about the economics, but also the politics of energy in this country. Wind is what we're talking about. Offshore wind in particular. Turbines almost as tall as the Eiffel Tower, 20 miles from the beach. And that kind of power was once considered nice, but pricey. Costs, though, have cratered. So up and down the East Coast, there are plans being made for wind farms out on the ocean. Plans. No actual farms. Last month, the Trump administration blocked the first big offshore installation, saying it wants to do more environmental impact studies. We gave Marketplace's Scott Tong a day off out from behind the sustainability desk and sent him up to New England to check things out.
Every afternoon at Point Judith, Rhode Island, commercial fishing boats pull in with a day's haul, including Brian Loftus's.
We have a couple hundred pounds of large scup. We've got a few butterfish over here.
He offloads one bin of fish after another. It totals 1,500 pounds. Loftus catches what are called groundfish at or near the sea bottom. The problem? Offshore wind companies plan to plop gigantic turbines in his fishing grounds.
Some of the grounds are just east of where the wind farms are. Some of them are right around where they want to put the wind farms. And there's a lot of other fish that migrate through there.
And he says wind farms could create ocean traffic jams. Loftus has a trawler boat with an undersea net that spreads 5 football fields wide and 5 football fields long.
You need space to maneuver. You know, these things don't turn around like a car coming out of your pocket space, you know.
Last month, the federal government halted the country's first big offshore wind project. It's called Vineyard Wind. The feds are now doing a new study on fishing impacts that could be huge, argues Megan Lapp at the Rhode Island squid company Seafreeze.
The largest wind farm in the world right now, it's in the UK,
okay,
is about 110 square miles.
Okay.
The lease area that Vineyard Wind is a part of is over 1,400 square miles. That's not even a little bit the same.
For the multi-billion dollar wind energy sector, this bureaucratic delay is a costly setback. The industry says eventually it can create 36,000 American jobs. Jobs kind of like this. At a port in Boston, union workers use cranes to drive giant pillars into the water to expand the port. 40 feet down, scuba divers with radios manage it all from below.
Hi, Scott. My name's Shane Bodecker. Currently, I'm working on installing pile wraps.
Shane Bodecker works for the local Pile Drivers and Divers Union. He surfaces and talks about job opportunities offshore.
I did consider going offshore in the Gulf after I graduated dive school, but I'd be a little bit more excited to be a part of a green energy movement that they're doing up here.
Installing and maintaining offshore turbines has rejuvenated port cities in Europe, says John Mitchell. He's the mayor of coastal New Bedford, Massachusetts. It's a fishing port that also wants wind jobs.
There are many cities that have seen significant job growth, folks who work on metal things, as well as folks who are putting together turbines. The most arresting image is just the scale of components themselves.
I have a chance to walk from one end of a gigantic turbine blade to the other in New Bedford. It takes 34 seconds. The Vineyard Wind Company declined an interview, but it said in a statement that the project would have no significant impact on fishing. What happens next is before the Interior Department. Last month, Interior Secretary David Bernhardt justified the new study, saying the government needs to pause and dot their I's and cross their T's. The department declined an interview with us. But is this really just a study or politics? Jesse Prentice Dunn is with the conservation group Center for Western Priorities.
This Interior Department in the Trump administration has done everything possible to reduce environmental reviews for drilling. And so to say that offshore wind suddenly needs more robust review seems rather hypocritical.
If this pause turns into a delay of a year or two, energy analysts say the whole U.S. offshore wind market could stall. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up.
And he just starts pounding the steering wheel.
When you hear something on the radio that makes you crazy. I know, right? But first, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go on this Wednesday. Dow Industrial's up 227 points, about 0.8%, 27,137. The NASDAQ rose 85 points, about 1%, 8169. S&P 500 banked 21.7%, and even 3,000 on the nose today. Uber and Lyft shrugged off that California news that we are in the middle of telling you about. Uber gained 1.5%, 1.5% is another way to say that. Lyft up 2.3% today. Apple is continuing to coast on the positive reviews to its product launches announced yesterday. The company's stock polished up more than 3% today. The industrial conglomerate 3M. Quick, who knows what that stands for? Come on. I'll wait. I got like 11 seconds. Nothing. All right. Down about 0.5% today. Bonds fell slightly. Yield on the 10-year T-note, essentially flat at 1.74%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Back we go now to the voyages of Marketplace's Ben Bradford through the gig economy, a slice of the American labor force that the state of California would like to have a word with us all about. When last we heard from Ben, he was in a nail salon talking to a worker there about what's known as California AB5, the new law out here that would mean thousands of people who are now classified as independent contractors would be switched over to being actual employees with all the pay and benefit changes that would mean. Anyway, Ben was out running around all morning, and by the time he got back to the office, he was hungry.
My editor ordered lunch via Postmates, and I was so happy to see Baltazar Montoya carrying a big brown paper bag with our food.
Hey, man. Yeah, thanks, man.
For Montoya, this is a side hustle. His main job is installing fire sprinklers for a union. He likes the extra money, particularly because there are months when he's off. But he also thinks Postmates could have more transparent pay. And as a union guy, he says he understands the power of collective bargaining.
If we became employees, we could probably talk about a base pay that a flat pay per delivery. You know, it might be easier than to have one of us just call and ask for stuff like that.
Labor unions have been some of the biggest backers of the California measure because employees can organize. But as independent contractors, gig economy workers lack the ability to collectively bargain with their companies.
Cool, man. Hey, very nice to meet you. Thanks so much, man. Appreciate it.
Marketplace's Ben Bradford there. One more coming up from him. Lest you think, by the way, that Uber and Lyft are taking AB5 lying down. That is the bill out here about to be signed into law. Well, they're not. They have each set aside tens of millions of dollars to fund a California ballot initiative campaign to let voters decide how they want their rideshare companies to be regulated. The American manufacturing sector loved it some Donald Trump his first 2 years in office. Jobs and new business, just like then-candidate Trump promised would happen when he was running. Last week, though, as we reported, U.S. factories actually said they are contracting, not as much business to be had, fewer jobs, in the wake of the president's trade war and global weakness. Sean Donnan's a senior writer at Bloomberg, just out with a long piece on the recession in American manufacturing right now. Sean, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So there was this number, as I talked about up in the introduction, the ISM number from, I don't know, a week or something ago, that said not great things about manufacturing. You've been out there talking to people running these companies, and they are not feeling great.
So look, I went and sat down with a guy called Greg Petras in Wisconsin, and he runs a company called Kuhn North America. And every morning he drives to work from a little bit further north near Madison. And when Donald Trump gets on the radio and says something about the trade wars and says that China's paying the tariffs, that just sets Greg Petras off. And he just starts pounding the steering wheel because he's a guy who is literally writing checks and signing checks to pay the cost of these tariffs. And it's really affecting his business. And he's had to put workers on temporary furloughs. Mm-hmm. A lot of that is about the trade wars.
Tell me, would you, why manufacturing matters in this company, in this country? I mean, you know, we still make things not like we used to. The president ran on manufacturing jobs and getting back to that iconic nature of this economy. Tell me why they matter.
Well, look, there's economically, they matter less than they used to. Manufacturing is about 10-12%. A lot less people work in manufacturing today. But it's where they work that's what matters. And they work in America's industrial heartland, what sometimes we call the Rust Belt. And those same states are going to matter next year in the election. And where manufacturing is going in those states matters a lot.
You mentioned 2016. Got to point out here that in 2016, we had, much like we have now, a little manufacturing recession.
Yeah, and that's one of the great ironies that we're looking at right now. It looks like Donald Trump and the trade wars managed to help replicate a little bit of the downturn that we saw in the manufacturing sector in 2015 and 16. The question now is, you know, are we just at the start of a similar downturn, or are we somewhere further along the line? And one of the other people I talked to for this piece was the CEO of Cummins, Tom Linebarger.
Yeah, they make big diesel engines.
Big diesel engine maker, right. And he is really worried about the slowdown in the trucking market. He thinks he's going to be selling a lot less diesel engines a year from now than he is today. And so he's already starting to plan for that and scaling back production and so on. That bodes badly for the broader industrial economy.
Is it, has the damage been done already, and is the future inevitable? Or if there was a deal tomorrow with China and all the rest of the people that the president is tariffing, would things bounce back reasonably quickly?
That's a really good question. I think there's a lot of damage that's been done already, but one of the big things that hangs over the manufacturing sector, like a lot of the U.S. economy, is the uncertainty around the trade piece. And that could change very quickly if we got a deal. You would get companies like Kuhn North America starting to invest again. At Kuhn, they've got a $4 million R&D facility that they'd love to build, but they're not going to build it until they know where the economy is going and where trade policy is going.
Sean Donnan, senior editor at Bloomberg, talking about manufacturing most recently. Sean, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
There's a whole lot wrapped up in this California change to how workers are treated as contractors or actual employees. I mean, yes, for the company, sure, it'll be more expensive. And if you're a pure play gig economy company like Uber or Lyft, it's a real business model challenge. But there are changes coming for workers, too, how they get scheduled and how much they're paid. Ben Bradford left the office one last time to get another perspective.
Oscar Arvizu has a conflicted relationship with Uber and Lyft. I find him outside the L.A. Grand Hotel in a shiny black Suburban. He's driven independently for years. He says Uber and Lyft hurt his business.
When they were not here, our business was totally different. I had a lot of clients.
But now, Arvizu drives some independently and other times turns on the apps, even though he says they don't pay much.
They give us nothing, man. Actually, driving this car, all I get is a gas money.
Still, Arvizu expresses the same concerns I heard from people I spoke with earlier about becoming an employee under California's new law.
I don't want to be an employee because I don't want to lose my freedom.
He thinks it'd tie him more tightly to the companies that upended his livelihood. Riding around in downtown Los Angeles, I'm Ben Bradford for Marketplace.
With the saga of Ben Bradford behind us and the changes to the California Labor Code that he spent all day reporting on and that are all but certain to be signed into law, a pause here for a moment of context. Gig economy jobs and the companies that offer them do have outsized influence, mostly for what they say about the future of the American labor force. But they do still account, as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman points out, for just a small fraction of present total employment in this economy.
So how many gig workers are there now? Depends on how you define it. Adam Ozimek at freelance platform Upwork says a study by his group and the Freelancers Union found
1 out of 3 workers
do some kind of freelance work sometime in the year. At the other end, former Labor Department chief economist Heidi Scherholz cites the latest number from the Bureau of Labor Statistics.
6.9% of workers were independent contractors. It's not a huge part of the labor force.
Bottom line, full-time traditional employment is still the main way most people earn most of their money. And people have always tried to earn some extra on the side. What's changing is how that work gets arranged, says self-employment expert Caroline Bruckner at American University. Global tech firms and their apps now act as middlemen between freelance workers and customers. Bruckner says if those firms end up having to reclassify their independent contractors as employees,
that is a sea change in terms of their bottom line.
They'd suddenly be subject to
Social Security, Medicare taxes, the employer portion of that,
plus minimum wage and workplace safety laws. Surveys find a lot of current gig workers like being independent, the flexibility, the extra income on top of a regular 9-to-5 job. But Carl Van Horn at Rutgers Center for Workforce Development says surveys also show most people
want a full-time job with benefits. They want predictability, they want stability in their life.
California's new law aims to give some of that to a lot of gig workers. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Final note on the way out today. Published reports this afternoon that the thousands of lawsuits filed against the opioid maker Purdue Pharma and its owners, the Sackler family, have been settled. Official announcement coming tomorrow. Apparently, the company as it exists files Chapter 11 bankruptcy. A new public benefit corporation is formed. It pays the plaintiffs. The Sackler family contributes $3 billion over 7 years. Total value of the thing is about $12 billion. No statement of wrongdoing is included, it is reported. Let me take this opportunity, though, for a quick promo. Our podcast, The Uncertain Hour, spent all of last season on this crisis and what it has done to the people and the economy of Wise County, Virginia. Check it out. It's really good. The Uncertain Hour. And with that, on this September 11th, we got to go. Dow Industrials up 227 points today, 0.8%. The NASDAQ up 85 points, 1%. S&P 521 points to the good, 0.7%. Our media production team includes Sarah Bergere, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Jay Siebold, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Holliday. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.